Hello, and welcome to episode number 106 of the Point of Convergence podcast. As always, I am your host, Exoacademian. Even as our modern mainstream society begins to grapple with the notion that non-human intelligences of a sophisticated nature are in our midst, piloting remarkably unconventional and beyond next-gen technological craft, there is still a key component of the cultural conversation that is missing, and that is the consideration of the testimony of those who have apparently already encountered these very intelligences. Now, if one were unfamiliar with experience or lore, one might conclude that we have almost zero understanding as to the intent of these various non-human others. In fact, this is basically what some, otherwise well-meaning pro-disclosure advocates have publicly stated, that we have no idea as to why they're here or what they want. But if and when one does pay attention to said experience or lore, it quickly becomes evident that nothing could be further from the truth. Now, does that mean that we should take everything said in these circles at face value? Certainly not. We still want to apply standard witness credibility criteria to these statements. And we also want to look for the aspects of the testimony that represent the greatest consensus. But to ignore this testimony altogether is not only unwise. After all, wouldn't we want to hear what has reportedly been said to those who've interacted with these beings? But it's also inaccurate and inauthentic, because it lets those new to the conversation believe that this is a complete unknown, which only adds to fear states that are already driving far too much of our contemporary societal dialogue. When one does pay attention to experience or testimony, it becomes clear that these beings have been speaking pretty pointedly to some very specific issues. One element that is brought up frequently is that we as a species have lost touch with our connection to the planet, and even more overarchingly, to the larger cosmic community of which we are all a part. Furthermore, not only is that disconnect unfortunate, but it is also highly consequential, because it is that misunderstanding that is giving rise to the very existential threats we are now facing as a collective. But beyond even these clearly and regularly stated messages, part of the communication also frequently touches on how we've lost touch with our most essential nature, a nature that stretches beyond the parameters of this one individual lifetime. In fact, it's made clear by many of these non-conventional beings that this loss of context is driving us into a kind of individual and collective madness, one where we let pursuits like materialism become the orienting principle of our lives, even when that dogged pursuit begins to devolve into disease in our collective consciousness, reflected in, among other things, ecological disaster and frayed human mental health. Of course, much of this speaks to the notion of journeys of souls, and even of so-called soul contracts. And if that's the case, what does this say of the nature of these beings? Are they quote-unquote spiritual figures, or quote-unquote biological ones, just like us? Of course, that false dichotomy is at the very heart of our present conundrum. Just who are these beings, and how does their very nature, and even their technology, tend to collapse our present paradigm? And how does the potential of that very collapse serve as a seed for a new way of being, one that restores the relationships we've so deeply fallen out of alignment with? These are the ultimate matters, both technological and metaphysical in nature, that we'll seek to engage with in this, the 106th episode of the Point of Convergence podcast. As we begin this week's episode, I would just like to remind everyone that if you would like to support this podcast, and in so doing gain access to all of my content, which includes Point of Convergence, Liminal Frames, and Event Horizon, along with the various feature series I create, and OTC Squared, as well as early access and discounts to classes I teach and retreats that I host, as well as access to my private Discord server, you can do so by going to patreon.com/exoacademian or by subscribing on Spotify. All right, let's jump into this week's topic. We are going to be discussing the nature of these beings, as well as ultimately what that says about our nature as well. And this is largely coming from experiencer testimony. As I hinted at in the beginning there, the challenge I see with our contemporary conversation in the mainstream is that experiencer testimony is basically being ignored. Even when I do see it being brought up, it's only being brought up in very specific ways to sometimes, for instance, reference the shock people initially experience when they first encounter these beings. But of course, there's much more to the story than that. And even that initial ontological shock doesn't speak to the nature of the beings or their intention or their agenda, but it speaks more to the fact that as biological creatures, this is a very shocking experience when we encounter beings that we assume cannot exist. When we, for instance, encounter beings that look like giant insectoids, of course, this is going to trigger our fight or flight mechanism. This is an evolutionarily derived response in us, but it doesn't speak to their nature. Furthermore, there are some differences between them and us in terms of behavior, and of course, we should expect that, and we're told to expect that, because we are dealing with a different species. And yet often people jump the gun and assume that we can quickly assume things about their nature, their intent, their agenda, etc., because of those initial differences, even in the way they tend to behave as a default. And to really underline this point, I want to point out to people that what we see happen over time is an evolution of understanding for the human being who's encountering these non-human others. That at first, that initial shock, as well as the fact that they have a more diminished emotional aspect compared to human beings, leads people to believe that they might not be their friends. This might be bad news. These might be nefarious beings. But over time, once that ontological shock begins to settle down and communication begins to occur, which is almost always, of course, telepathic, eventually we do see a shift, not 100% of the time, but in many, many of the cases when people have time to reflect on their experiences and the actual activity of these beings and the communication they receive from these beings, they come to move towards more of a neutral and often a positive overall interpretation of these experiences and a very positive overall interpretation of the intention of these creatures, even though part of that process involves a cracking open of the human psyche to allow for a much more expansive worldview to take root. That can feel like an ontologically shocking experience. That can feel like some part of you is dying a kind of ego death, but it gives birth to, it gives rise to a more expansive understanding that is exactly what these beings tell us the cosmic family kind of takes as the norm, that we're connected to everything, including the planet, each other, them, and that ultimately we are all, they as well as us, iterations of source consciousness. Now, speaking of source consciousness, what we're going to get into today a lot is this marrying of science and spirituality. We often think of these as two separate categories, two completely different domains or field of study. But what you find when you really delve into this subject matter is that there is overlap here, that for them, technology is involved in the embodiment of souls. That's actually central to their entire purpose here. It's central to the enterprise that they've been involved in since the very seeding of our species, that it's involved not just the seeding of humankind, but also the evolution of humankind over time through augmentation. And this is not just energetic, nor is it just genetic. It's both and. They are architects of soul science, and they do what they do in such a way that they know how to basically house spiritual potential or souls, if you will, within biological life forms. They have been working on this for a long period of time. This is kind of what they are all about, is the architecting of civilizations and the technological process involved in housing spirits or souls within particular bodies. And they actually work to augment the genetics of those bodies so as to allow for greater spiritual expression and greater spiritual insights. And this is, for instance, demonstrated in the augmentation we've seen in our species over time. I've talked about this many times before on this podcast, as well as on Liminal Frames, where basically we see, even in our evolutionary history, moments where there seems to be a leap, where the cognitive capacity of human beings suddenly seems to dramatically rise, much more than we would assume would be the case, if it was just happening through quote-unquote naturalistic processes. Of course, what's tricky here is that, again, as a species, we still tend to think of spiritual matters as being distinct from scientific matters. But these borders really are just something that we have constructed based on our temporary and mostly illusory perception. And I say illusory because this is the way things seem within the construct, within the simulation, if you will. But again, they have access both within and without this construct. So they understand the base nature of reality, the source code, if you will, of reality. They are actually architecting with some of that source code so as to create beings within the construct of space-time. Now, of course, what's key here is that we are still souls that transcend this particular construct, and that's why we have the capacity ourselves to tap into deeper levels of reality that are more overarchingly substantial, which is exactly why people often describe these experiences in these other realms as more real than real, much more substantive than this one, because this is a simulation. And when you have the contrast in hand, you can actually feel, see, note the difference, and recognize that this really is a secondary construct, and as I often say, a stage set for the evolution of consciousness. Now, before we proceed much further, I want to offer a couple of caveats or disclaimers, if you will. First of all, not all encounters are the same. I'm not painting with a broad brush every kind of encounter with an apparently non-human intelligence that people end up experiencing. And even within these different experiences, there are different kinds of groups that, again, are operating under different stages of consciousness development. So this does not apply across the board to every kind of non-human other that we might encounter. What I'm speaking to here, though, is a very specific kind of enterprise that has been centrally involved in this phenomenon since about the middle part of the 20th century. So from about the time of the atomic era on, we've seen dramatic rise in certain kinds of encounters, and we've seen the rise of the abduction and hybridization campaign. Now, just to be clear, this isn't to say that every single time someone is abducted and some sort of medical procedure seems to take place that might be part of a hybridization program, that is all part of the same thing. I think there are different kinds of species of non-human intelligence here, and the human life form is very interesting to many of them. So there are some outlier groups that are also conducting sometimes hybridization campaigns of one sort or another. But within that totality, there's one very overarching campaign that's been happening since the latter half of the 20th century on, where we see a pretty vast enterprise involving the abduction of many, many human beings and across generations often as well, in service of this hybridization enterprise. And by this, I mean genetic material, reproductive genetic material is taken from human beings and used in such a way as to produce hybrid beings that seem to be a combination of a human being, a contemporary Homo sapiens sapien, and something like what we would call a gray alien. Now, to many people, again, this might seem nefarious or somehow seems to rob us of our spiritual core. But again, what I want to point out today is I think that's a misunderstanding, and it assumes certain things about reality that are just not really accurate. These beings that I'm talking about, even though they can come across as kind of gruff at first and non-communicative in terms of being really clear about their intention, actually are working for the greater good. And that greater good includes not just humankind, though. This is very important to point out. It centrally involves the Earth and the entire biosphere, as well as our eventual introduction into something more like a galactic kind of confederation. So this is all considered when they work with us here. And to be clear, it's an imperfect science. It is soul science, but it's not perfect. So what we find, for instance, amongst many of the abductees is that when they were introduced to the first generation of hybrids, many of them seem to be failing to thrive. They seem to be quite listless biological beings. But by the time they were introduced to the second generation of hybrids, they seem to be thriving. They seem to be physically strong and mentally sharp, but contain psychic or intuitive capacities that far exceed those of contemporary Homo sapiens sapiens. In that sense, an upgrade that really is designed, again, not just to provide a new way for souls to experience more of reality in a more expansive way, but also souls that are now embodied in such a way that they will be in better relationship with the planet. So this is really about the greatest good for the largest context, which does not just include the future for human beings, although that is definitely part of the picture. Again, we're so used to being the center of attention, and we've assumed that we've been the apex species all along. What is a shock to our system is that we are not, we never have been, and the decisions are made from a higher point on the spiral, if you will, for the sake of the greatest good, of which human beings, as we experience ourselves, is just one of the ingredients, though it is an important ingredient in this overall consideration. Now, perhaps based on the first part of this conversation here, you might feel, as a modern Homo sapiens sapien, a little bit like a specimen that's being used as part of some larger enterprise, which perhaps robs you of some sense of agency. But this is the second aspect that I really want to counter in this conversation today, because we absolutely have agency, although where we assume that agency is placed is different than we've long assumed to be the case within the body mind that we usually inhabit. So one of the first real revelations here is not just that this hybridization campaign is taking place, but that when human beings are on board the craft or in these non-ordinary states, they seem to often recognize these beings, not initially, by the way. Often when they first see them, as I mentioned before, they will kind of freak out. They will have a fight or flight response because what looks like a large bug is right there in front of them, and that makes our skin crawl, kind of literally. But then what happens is some different kind of modality often kicks in. Some sort of memory block is removed, some sort of filter is taken down, and at that moment, human beings often recognize these others, and not just recognize them, but feel this deep familiarity as if they've known these beings for a very long time, and very consequentially, often for timelines that extend beyond this particular lifetime or beyond this incarnation. So again, we're back to spirit science here, that these beings are working on enterprises that stretch beyond one lifetime, but across many lifetimes, actually, sometimes, at least within this human form. And very essentially, what we find is that when this greater capacity for memory comes online and we have basically the filter removed that was preventing us from fully experiencing or knowing who we truly are, and again, that's done so that we will really feel like we have skin in the game in this construct, in this simulation, so that we can experience it like a stage set for the evolution of consciousness, where because we have skin in the game, we get the resistance training that leads to soul wisdom growth. But in this time where we are in their presence, they temporarily remove that block, take it down, so that we remember who we ultimately are, and we remember that we were part of this process. We were volunteering to be involved in this very endeavor. And this means that we have a soul that's on a journey and experiencing different kinds of constructs, different kinds of experience so as to grow in soul wisdom. But in collaboration with that, the grays will actually work to architect species and work on, again, perfecting the soul science of embodying souls within different kinds of forms in these different constructs. So this gets tricky because, again, where we assume these dividing lines are get challenged once again, because who we are extends far beyond this particular lifetime and far beyond this particular form on top of that. So, of course, many people report having memory of what we call past lives, and we often assume those are one after another after another. It doesn't really quite work like that either. Time only really exists within the construct. But what we have here is actually not just multiple lifetimes as humans, but often people remember experiences as a gray alien or some other kind of form, because again, part of the soul wisdom you can gain is partly imparted through the particular biological form that you are presently inhabiting. So we learn a lot from being a human being, where we have a really vast spectrum of emotional experience, both from euphoric kind of ecstatic states to deeply depressive states as well, and everything in between. Not every life form in the cosmos has that kind of range of experience. This is something that's known about human beings. Again, that's partly why we are an interesting form to study and work with for some of these other kinds of beings that are at that soul science kind of architecture kind of level. But we choose to take on these forms because of the range of experience that they afford. And of course, that should give us pause when we think about what it feels like sometimes to be a human being. We can sometimes feel very desperate that we're at the end of our rope, so to speak. But here we want to remember, if we can, that this is part of the process we signed up for, that learning how to navigate and metabolize and transmute energy is what we're here to do, to learn to have a more empowered perspective where our soul wisdom grows and we have more of a direct impact on the construct all around us. So eventually we take on the kind of capability they have, some of these more sophisticated forms where they can actually work with the source code and manifest and co-author these reality scapes that we find ourselves embedded within as these various biological forms. So what I hope is forming here in your mind is a larger contextual understanding that changes how you think about the nature of the enterprise in one particular subframe, if you will. So in a subframe, we experience reality as human beings in this form, and we think that's the sum total of what we are. Even when people talk about reincarnation, they assume it just means coming back as another human being, and that's basically what's available to us. When we pass that kind of test, we eventually go to a place like heaven or nirvana is something we experience, something like that. But of course, that's just one subframe within a much larger spiral of consciousness development. But when you highly identify with this particular form and you assume this is all you are, then what you end up with is notions like the fact that we live on a prison planet or that we are a farmed species, quote unquote. So these are some of the notions you hear bantied about within ufology. And again, from a certain perspective, you could perhaps see it that way, but really it doesn't apply when you think about the larger perspective. So if we are souls that choose different experiences to grow in soul wisdom, to basically be instantiations of source consciousness that are pursuing understanding the nature of reality through experience so as to ultimately return and reunite with source, having fully taken that full journey, then of course we look at this particular iteration and even this particular form where it might involve multiple lifetimes as a particular form, we see that as just one chapter in a much larger story. So thinking about it like a prison planet is really the wrong way to look at it. If anything, I would say look at it like a school. Now, if you are going to look at it a certain way, that will often be determined by your stage of consciousness. So this is another key aspect here, is that when we look at experiencer data, of course we can't say we can just reduce it to the stage of consciousness of the person having the experience, but this does play a vital role in the entire endeavor. And this leads me to something I posted to social media within the last week or so. I said, quote, "With a background in integral theory and spiral dynamics, it's very clear to me that one cannot separate an interpretation of this phenomenon from the stage of consciousness it is being parsed within. Remember, every event witnessed is an interpreted experience," unquote. So again, if your context and your contextual understanding is limited, it's going to fundamentally skew how you think about a certain situation. And I would argue that's exactly what's happening for many people who assume we are on a prison planet and we are a farmed species. Again, at the higher level of consciousness, we are a soul who's chosen to take part in this entire endeavor, which means we've partnered with these graves through soul science to embody within this form, which allows us a certain experience that we're looking for so we can further our growth and our understanding as we expand our capacity as an instantiation of source, which, by the way, that's exactly what they are as well. When we communicate with them and get to this level of understanding, while we've gotten past some of the initial fright, this is some of the conversation that is had, is that they understand themselves to be instantiations of source. That's all there is basically this iterating on source consciousness, that they are taking part in that process as well. And for them, they are now at the stage where they architect entire civilizations and basically conduct soul science that allows new instantiations of Source to come into existence through these various constructs so that they can begin their own journey, and on it goes. So this is all about different stages of consciousness across different kinds of forms. Again, and even within humankind, we find some people who are particularly still identified with this body-mind, that they think what I am is where I was born and who I was born to and what time I was born in terms of what era, etc. But for instance, in certain non-dual circles, like in Buddhist thought, for instance, we understand that this body-mind is not all we are, and that our illusion of separation is fundamental to our misunderstanding and to the disease of modern life. I say dis-ease in terms of the way that we're not really in alignment with things, that it's because we have misapprehended what we truly are that we have ended up in this kind of predicament. And by the way, speaking of soul science and how it's not a perfect process, it's an imperfect process, actually, this also applies in terms of what humankind began as and what we've become. So initially, you have to seed a civilization with quite an aggressive, active kind of nature so as to allow it to scramble out of prehistory and plant itself firmly in the natural world and begin to thrive as a species, become the dominant species on the planet, etc. So they seeded us with certain defaults so that that would happen. The challenge is that kind of grabbing function, if you want to call it something, that was central to us becoming what we became as a species, as the dominant biological life form on planet Earth, has also led to all the excesses of materialism and the illusion of separation leading to so much of our present circumstance in terms of these adversarial relationships where we don't even make decisions together as a tribe, as a planetary civilization. Instead, we are fighting against each other, racing to certain ends to beat each other without taking the time to think about if that is a wise enterprise in itself. So the very defaults that allowed us to become the apex species of the biological world anyway on planet Earth are the same defaults that now are giving rise to many of our problems, where we don't know how to dial back this kind of grabbing function. And because of that, we are now pursuing a completely unsustainable trajectory and seemingly unable to stop ourselves, like a runaway train. Many people sense that something's wrong, but we don't know how to change the system. The system seems bigger than all of us. And this is related to some of this default in terms of soul science of humankind. And so some of these beings have been directly intervening at various points to augment our genetic capacities so as to try to change that eventual course that we will take. This sometimes involves changing existing human beings, and it also sometimes involves inserting hybrid beings into the populace so as to slowly over time reduce the aggressive, self-centered, adversarial kind of defaults. Now, earlier on, I mentioned that some of the apparent gruffness that people encounter with these beings is sometimes misinterpreted. And again, here we have cross-species kind of miscommunication, mistranslation, that kind of thing. And it's a little bit ironic because while we talk about an anthropocentric bias that we have to watch out for, we still assume that they're going to greet us and communicate with us in the same way we do amongst our own species. But of course, they are a different species. And actually, because they're closer to Source much of the time, they actually don't identify so much with their bodies. They actually identify more as spirit or energy that is housed temporarily within a body. So what that means is that they generally have a high respect for the soul, but not nearly as much respect or regard for the body. And this is, again, sometimes misinterpreted, and people feel uncared for, and that these beings are acting kind of in a capricious manner. But that's not really what's going on, again, with this one particular enterprise I'm referring to here with the hybridization campaign. It's just that they understand they have a job to do, and they understand that at the higher spiral, your soul was part of the process of deciding to begin this entire process. So they also understand, though, that they can't tell you all of that. Sometimes they can't anyway, because that, again, takes away from you feeling like you have skin in the game in terms of being on a stage set for the evolution of your consciousness. In other words, if you knew what this actually was, that this was all just a game, you wouldn't take it seriously. You wouldn't feel the pressures that actually allow you to learn to transmute energies and grow in soul wisdom. So the trick is you have to kind of like buy into the game. You have to believe it's real so that you actually experience it in such a way that you learn to work with the energies. And that wisdom you gain, you take with you, even when you leave the construct long behind. Now, this also plays into the way that they gather reproductive material from human beings as part of this hybridization campaign. So again, their regard is for the soul, less for the body, which isn't to say they sometimes don't try to comfort people. They do. They do try to communicate at various points. Now, of course, we have some of the beings that seem to be more like androids, biological kind of robots that are very much all business-like. Again, it's not personal. It's just that they're there to do a certain job. Often if there is comfort offered and more of a relational communication, it comes from beings that seem to be higher on the hierarchy and not from these biological automatons, if you will. And to really underline this point in terms of differentiating soul from body, I want us to think about how we consider plants and how they reproduce. Obviously, that involves sexual functionality, but we just don't tend to sexualize plants in the same way that we do sexualize ourselves. We understand that emotions and whatnot are wrapped up in our sexuality, but we don't think that way when we think about plants. So think, for instance, about pollen and how that's a sexual aspect of a plant's life. So pollen grains produced by the male part of a flower carry the male reproductive cells, the sperm, if you will, which need to reach the female part of another flower to fertilize the egg and produce a seed. When pollen lands on a compatible stigma, is what it's called, it germinates and grows a pollen tube that delivers the sperm to the ovule where fertilization occurs. Now, the key here is to think about how you regard your own sexuality in a very different way than you do when we talk about what's happening with plants. And yet, functionally, it's the same thing going on. This is about how do you reproduce a species? How do you take a female and a male and produce a new organism as a result? And that's kind of how these particular beings look at us. They see this as about taking bodies, removing certain reproductive material, and scientifically working with that material in such a way as to produce new beings, much like what we might want to do when we decide we want to grow a new kind of orchid with a slightly different color. We would pursue certain processes, work with existing orchids to produce this in kind of a trial and error kind of mix. And we wouldn't really regard the orchids or really think about how it might impact them. Now, I don't want to make this a one-to-one kind of comparison here. They do understand us in a more complex way than we understand orchids, but it does go to show that they think about our sexual function as being the way that new biological organisms are created and less about the emotional aspect. Again, partly because they have a different emotional aspect themselves, and they are not sexual creatures anymore. They may have been at one point, but they are not now. So they don't have this ability to relate in the same way that we do amongst ourselves. So again, we have to watch out for anthropocentric bias, recognize that they regard the soul more than the body, and remember that ultimately, to start this entire process, our souls and kind of the oversoul kind of level chose to refract into this particular kind of function, this particular kind of form, and that was working with the grays, who are architects of species and conducting soul science to embody spirit within form within this particular construct. And to carry this analogy a little bit further, I would like us also to consider how we work with animal species, either because we're trying to act in ways that benefit that species or because we're acting in such a way as to benefit the overarching ecosystem. So we all know that sometimes that means we will track and capture, sometimes tranquilize certain animals to take them into our care, where we then conduct various medical experiments. We often tag them so we can track them, and then we reintroduce them to the ecosystem. And we will sometimes make overarching decisions about a particular species in terms of how it will impact the overarching ecosystem. And we feel like it's completely within our rights as the dominant species, as it were, to make those kind of decisions, even when it impacts the lives of individual animals and even individual species within an ecosystem. So we do that without thinking twice. And yet somehow when we put ourselves in that position where we are no longer the apex species, and the same decisions with the same kinds of considerations are being made about an even more overarching ecosystem, we somehow don't look at it the same way. But I would again challenge that kind of assumption and ask us to be consistent and not hypocritical in the way we think about these matters, remembering again that this is just one particular construct, one particular form we're taking temporarily, and not central to who we ultimately are and what we ultimately are, which is, again, iterations of source going through this process across many forms and many lifetimes. Now, earlier on, I mentioned how there are some cross-species differences, some errors in translation, if you will, that we do have to take into account. Another one of these is that, as I hinted at before, they don't have nearly as much of a strong identification with their bodies. They very much see bodies as receptacles that can house consciousness, but that this consciousness can be moved around. And in fact, they can duplicate and often do duplicate bodies so that they can move consciousness between bodies and that kind of thing. Now, somehow to us, this seems like it's violating some sort of universal rule. But again, that's largely because we so identify with our bodies and we assume that we are our bodies. When we think about minds, for instance, we assume, and we've been taught for a long time, that our brains basically are our minds. So we have often, of course, been led to believe that when our bodies dissolve, there's nothing to us there never was. What these beings understand is that nothing could be further from the truth, that these bodies are largely irrelevant to the underlying fundamental nature of what we are. So that's something to keep in mind. And this also is reflected in the fact that they don't often refer to themselves by names. They actually can identify each other by energetic configuration or energetic structure or like in a cosmic signature, that's how they interact with each other. Furthermore, they often don't even use pronouns. So someone might, for instance, have one of these beings telepathically communicating to look in their direction, but rather than saying, look at me, like we might, they would just say, look here, because again, they don't have that strong identification with the particular body and the location where that body is being the sum total of what they are. So that's something to keep in mind too. Just want to highlight here that while we talk about anthropocentric bias, we are acting on that all over the place and not recognizing it, and that's part of the problem we're running into. In fact, even recently when certain disclosure advocates that generally are really helpful in this process sometimes make conclusions around these beings not being helpful based on a certain narrow framing of what it would look like for them to be benevolent, helpful beings. But what I'm pointing out here is that because they have in mind the much larger context, then saving this particular civilization in its current form is not the number one priority. Evolving souls is the number one priority, even if that means sometimes encountering disaster or cataclysm. Sometimes that has to happen for certain souls to metabolize a certain kind of wisdom. I'm not saying that's going to happen, but I'm saying that their first priority is not saving us from ourselves. It's about maturing us so that we will save ourselves and we will take a turn so as to operate in the future based on the benefit of the whole. And I mean a much more expansive whole than we tend to consider now. Certainly not just our species, not even just our planet, but the larger cosmic whole. And it's only once you have that perspective, and I think this should be obvious once you think about it, that a species demonstrates that it's ready to be welcomed into something like a galactic confederation, because then you are acting in the interest of the federation, of the galactic whole, and not acting like a cancer cell that could violate or hurt or even destroy the overarching organism. We've spent a lot of time today talking about the abduction and hybridization campaign, and while that is central to this enterprise, and again, because they are committed to the process they also signed up for, they're going to act to make sure that that campaign is successful, even if it takes multiple iterations, like I discussed earlier, in terms of multiple generations of hybrids. That's not all they're about. They also help us to expand our awareness through various practices they introduce us to. So for instance, that means many of the abductees who've developed more of a communication with these beings, a more relational kind of dynamic, often talk about, for instance, being taught to fly the craft. And while you might think that would be pretty involved in having to understand the technology and what does what in terms of a console, it turns out that's not the case. And that's because you basically use your mind to operate this craft. And most of their technology actually is involving a direct interface with mind, with consciousness impacting other kinds of consciousness, remembering that the entire construct ultimately underlyingly is made up of the same fabric, that is consciousness. So once you understand that, and once you have an understanding of yourself as an iteration of that, then you can work with it directly. So they will often teach people to use their minds to fly the craft. They will often also, when abductees are young, because again, often they are taken from a young age on, the first 10 years or so have nothing to do with the hybridization campaign, of course, because they're not sexually mature yet. So even before their adolescence, they are taken on board the craft or sometimes taken into a non-ordinary realm so as to begin to work with their minds. For instance, manifesting three-dimensional objects and moving them around with their minds. It often begins with visualization and eventually moves to manifestation. So they are teaching people practically how to not only just have greater capacities, but how to actualize those, how to grow the skill set so as to be more effective in how they can use their minds to impact reality directly. And again, this is not just for the sake of the people who are involved in this process and in this training. It has to do with the world to come, the transition that lies in our future and probably not terribly far into our future, where these kinds of capacities become part of the operation of the new world, where we have more of a direct interaction between our consciousness and the consciousness fabric all around us. And many of these people will serve as ambassadors to help with that transition, not only in terms of managing the communication between these other beings and Homo sapiens sapiens, but also in terms of showing human beings how to begin to use these capacities as well, with the notion being that the world to come will be quite different than the world we've existed upon thus far. So as we draw this particular episode to a close, I'd like us to think about what we've discussed today in light of this societal-wide conversation around disclosure. So we often talk about getting to the point where we as a society recognize that we are not alone, that there are other sophisticated non-human intelligences in our midst. What we've discussed today, of course, expands that conversation considerably, because just as central to the matter is not who they are, but who we are, that our fundamental nature is exposed indirectly, if you will, once you really get into the depth and breadth of what is actually involved here. That this is as much about our path, our future, as it is about their presence and where they come from. And of course, this will involve a considerable shift for our civilization, a shift in fundamental understanding. This is true both of secular people and of scientists, as it is of religious people around the world as well. Each of these conceptions will have to evolve to basically metabolize this new information. And this leads me to something else I posted to social media, where I said, quote, "One of the most challenging points of reconciliation coming for billions involves the notion that while we are not the apex intelligence, and while we have been a seeded and managed species, we do still have individual agency, and the greatest good is being served," unquote. So, of course, that kind of revelation involves not just new information, but a fundamental shift in our understanding of the context entirely. Everything is impacted by this revelation, and that's why I often say this is the one topic that leaves no other topic unscathed. Before I sign off, I also want to point out that if you're interested in learning more about how to prepare for the kind of radical transparency that will be the norm in this new world, these are the kind of things we do discuss in the Expanding Awareness class that I offer. And that class is beginning this upcoming week. Tuesday is when it starts. So if you're interested, you can check out my website that discusses the class, which is essenceofbeing.info. So go there if you're interested in learning more about the Expanding Awareness class. Again, that begins this upcoming Tuesday, September 3rd. And on that note, we've come to the close of another edition of the Point of Convergence podcast. If you'd like to support this podcast, you can do so by going to patreon.com/exoacademian or by subscribing on Spotify. But until next time, friends, from deep within the Blue Ridge Mountains of North Carolina, this is Exoacademian, signing out.